Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
This week's guest, Markham Hislop, has turned his full attention to energy. He considers being called the man in the middle of the road a compliment. On the one hand, he believes the climate debate is settled, that the energy transition started 10 to 15 years ago, and the global economy is slowly adopting the clean energy tech needed to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. But on the other hand, he contends it will take the rest of the century to do it. So what worries Mr. Hislop is that clean energy boosters are getting too far ahead of the technology. He expects oil and gas will compete with renewables for many decades before finally losing the battle for market share. Interestingly, he says BC's moving too fast and Alberta is moving too slow. He says both provinces need to align their objectives and stop going head-to-head. So to talk about the largest energy revolution since the introduction of electricity, we sat down with Markham Hislop for a conversation that matters. Markham Hislop, welcome to Conversations That Matter.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. You write about the energy industry in Canada primarily, but energy in general. You write very interesting stuff. And when I look at it, when I first started reading your material, I thought, oh, you're all pro oil and carbon-based energy. And then I started reading a lot of your articles and you're like, no, not necessarily. So where do you stand on where we are as far as carbon-based fuels in North America, maybe even globally, and where are we going?
I can actually answer that question, Stu. Well, a lot of my work is built around an analysis of, and reporting on the energy transition. And so 30 years ago when I was a lowly graduate student at the University of Saskatchewan, I did my master's thesis on the transition from horse-drawn technology to power farming technology, 1900 to 1930. Mm-hmm. And what I found about 5 years ago, I started doing a lot of energy journalism, is that all of the theory and the little model that I had developed for use in my thesis applied really well to energy technology, whether it be fossil fuels or whether it be clean energy tech. So what I did was I started working on, you know, all of the stories about that technology, and it very quickly became apparent that we really were at the beginning of the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy tech.
So why are we, let's first of all address, why are we on that path right now? Is it because there has been a response globally to what is going on with regards to the environment?
Partly. There's absolutely no doubt that the debate around climate change has changed people's attitudes. But the change that I'm talking about, the energy transition, is really rooted in technological change. That technological change changes economies, economies change politics, and politics changes culture. So It really is rooted in the technology. And what happened is about 5 or 10 years ago, or maybe let's say the year 2000, just to make it convenient, is there was an explosion, if you will, of solar and wind and electric vehicles and power grids and batteries. All of these things began to, the technology that had been around for a long time began to get traction in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And then we saw around, you know, late 2008, we had the Nissan Leaf, so you got an EV. We started seeing solar maybe 10, 12 years ago. And all of that has been accelerating. And if you think of an S curve, which is how you track technology diffusion, all of that technology, or much of it, is still at the very bottom of it, but now we're talking about thousands of technologies. And the technology has really taken root, and it is in the process. It will eventually replace fossil fuels, but it'll be a 100-year process. It won't be done until probably 2100 on a global basis. Like right now, we use about 82 to 85% of our energy comes from fossil fuels. By 2100, that percentage will be renewable energy, 82 to 85% renewables. So that's where we're going. I call it the electric utopia. That's where we're headed off
to. So are you talking mostly wind and solar then?
Well, I'm talking about, it could be hydro, wind, solar. BC Hydro is talking about tidal power. you know, maybe in 20 years. We're talking about geothermal, anything that's any kind of energy generation.
Geothermal, I understand, it's pretty tricky.
Sure.
Everybody goes, oh yeah, it is this magic formula. But I talked to Ross Beatty, who has Altera Power. He actually has a couple of geothermal plants running, and he goes, not doing anymore.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Because we're in 2017, and maybe today it's uneconomic and it's not very efficient. And by 2050, that might be different. But it doesn't matter, because solar and wind, the cost curves on those are dropping fast enough that the wind for sure is now competitive with natural gas and coal, and solar is right behind it. So it's that kind of technological change that's driving the transition.
Mm-hmm.
And but one of the point, and you brought up this basic conflict between clean energy tech and fossil fuels, and the reason I write about both is because for 40 or 50 or 60 years, while that transition is taking place, they're going to compete. And we're going to need fossil fuels while the clean energy technology is developing and while it's gaining traction in the marketplace. So it's not, in fact, it's perfectly consistent to realize that we need all of these sources of energy, and it's how we manage the transition. It's not an either or, it's an all of the above until the clean energy technology is ready to be dominant.
So the way you talk, you say it's as though the debate's over. We're moving in that direction.
Debate's
plain
over.
And simple.
Debate's over, it's done.
And yet there are a lot of people who are still trying to hang on to the fact that no. We need this as a resource-based sector. Because, number one, it provides jobs and it provides revenue for governments and supports a way of life and a quality of life. So what do you say to those people who are in that sector and they're trying to hang on to that?
Well, what I say is that, and I should point out that most of our readers are in BC and Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm in Calgary and I'm talking to the oil and gas executives, I say, come on, guys, you got to speed up. I mean, we have the Paris Climate Accord. We're heading into an increasingly carbon-constrained world. The technology is changing. This is not the 1990s. It's 2017. You got to get with it. When I'm in BC, on the other hand, and especially when I'm in Vancouver, now I'm talking about, slow down. Well, hang on a second. We can't move too fast. You remember the climate leadership team recommendations from last year and how angry they were about some of them weren't recommended? Well, some of them were a little out on the edge. And Christy Clark actually, cautious was a good move on her part.
Mm-hmm.
But over in Vancouver, in BC, in the Lower Mainland, everybody here wants to move quicker towards that electric utopia, and Alberta doesn't want to move as quick. So that's why I have different messages for different audiences, but it still reflects that fundamental analytical model of the energy transition and competing energy technology.
So if we're moving to a innovation technological base, the oxygen of that environment is electricity. Where
yes.
are we going to get the electricity from?
Well, if we're talking about electric vehicles, for instance, electric motors are 4 to 5 times more efficient than an internal combustion engine. So you need less BTUs to make the same things happen. I mean, if the engine that you have in your car only gets 15 to 20% of the energy that's actually in the gasoline.
Okay.
Whereas an electric motor, the efficiencies can be up in the 80s. The Chevy Bolt, for instance, at peak efficiency is 97%. It's way higher. And that's
wow.
one of the reasons why the electric revolution is going to be so much better and more efficient than the fossil fuel revolution. You spend a lot. The only reason fossil fuels work is because they're so much more energy dense
mm-hmm.
than batteries. Batteries have a very low energy density.
But that's changing.
That's changing.
Yeah.
But, electrochemistry has only been around for 40 or 50 years. I mean, it's still, a young science. So batteries are going to get better. It just takes time to get there.
But at some point, we have to charge them. And we also have to have electricity to run everything else that's in our life.
Mm-hmm.
We're sitting here in a province where we're saying no to Site C. Or there's a number of people who are saying no to Site C. And if they do so, are we not then restricting our own ability to move to this new energy paradigm that you're talking about?
Maybe. And I say maybe because I interviewed Paul Correa from the BC
yes.
Clean Energy Association.
Mm-hmm.
So he he claims that his members put in a proposal to BC Hydro that all of the 1.1 terawatts that Site C would provide, they could provide that over the next 20 years on an incremental basis from solar, from wind, some gas peakers, some run of the river, and they could do it as it's needed so that you don't have to build this great big dam and then hope that your population increases and hope that, you know, your demand grows.
Well, if we're moving to all everything electrical, is not demand going to increase?
Well, you know, then that's up for debate because energy efficient, we're getting so much more energy efficient. We do way more work with the same amount of energy than we used to. I think the IEA estimates that the global economy uses one-third less energy over the last 20 or 30 years than it used to per unit of GDP.
Through efficiency.
And that's only going, efficiency is a big part of the Canadian government's climate change policies. It's a big part of now pretty much every provincial government. It is here in BC and getting better. We're seeing initiatives at the Vancouver City level. Not all of them pushing the envelope a little bit, but nevertheless,
that's a move towards more electricity as well. They're doing in the city of Vancouver.
You take out natural gas, you've got to replace those BTUs with something.
Right.
So one of the things that we can be guaranteed about, Stu, is that this process is going to be a little bit messy, you know, and we're going to make some mistakes. But generally, I think the people who are looking at this, the experts that I interview, say the generation and distribution of electricity to meet that rising demand as we use less fossil fuels is not the biggest problem we're going to face.
Which is? What is that biggest problem?
Well, I think the problem, there's a number of them, but one of them is going to be trying to move quicker than the technology will allow us. So, you know, for instance, right now, California has got a zero emission vehicle campaign. And they had all sorts of lofty goals, you know, when Governor Jerry Brown brought it in, they're not going to meet any of them.
Right.
And they're going to spend $1 billion on charging infrastructure that, in my opinion, will probably be, useless in 5 years because we're going to go on to some other kind of model for electric vehicles. So that's the problem is governments that get too aggressive, make mistakes on the policy side, waste taxpayers' dollars, and sometimes, like in Ontario, lock the economy into bad policy that then costs a lot of money, costs consumers a lot of money, and takes money away that could be spent better spent elsewhere on energy transition policies.
So then, how do governments go about making informed decisions that are going to make sense when none of us know exactly how this is all going to play itself out?
Be cautious. That's my advice to government is, you know, work with the technology that you have. So, for instance, in Alberta, the NDP government there under Rachel Notley decided, they introduced a climate leadership plan in 2015, and part of that is to replace, they had 51% of their power came from coal.
Right.
So they're going to replace that with a combination of natural gas and wind. Well, wind power actually right now is competitive with coal and gas. And what I'm being told is that there are some other innovations coming, like broader span of the blade, and higher heights that will actually increase the efficiency even more, bring the cost down. So a combination of gas and wind could effectively replace that coal, but the technology is basically there.
In Alberta, that works because you can place those windmills much closer to the point of need. Whereas here, where our wind tunnels are, they're a long way away just from the grid.
Well, when I interviewed a couple years ago, I interviewed the VP of Strategic Planning, whose name I've forgotten at this point, but he said, look, we want to do Site C. There's a lot of efficiencies that can be gained. And then after that, we're going to do tidal.
Yeah.
He said, we figured, you know, tidal 20 years down the road. And so that was their plan. And the impression I get from this debate is that the Clark government Hydro didn't do a really good job of explaining to British Columbians why this was needed. It's not clear. And It's unfortunate. I mean, the Horgan government now says it's going to send that Site C to the BC Utilities Commission for review.
Which, as I understand, isn't really the agency that should be reviewing this, because they're about, well, how do we provide the lowest cost delivery of electricity, not right. Is this the right decision?
So difficult political issue, difficult technical issue, difficult policy issue for the new government, and maybe if we have an election soon for whatever government comes after it. But nevertheless,
this goes to exactly what you're talking about, move right. cautiously.
Yes, that is, I think, the watchword. And the I interviewed a fellow named Tim Grajic, who is an electrochemist / battery analyst for a company called Lux Research out of Denver. Mm-hmm. And what he said is, 20 to 25 years from now, when we look back, he said, we're going to be surprised because the change will in all of these technologies will appear to have been slow at the time as we live through them. But when we look back on it from that vantage point, we're going to be shocked at how much things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you wait 2 years or 5 years or 8 years or 10 years, then your options change. And now you're talking about maybe much cheaper technology, much more efficient technology, different ways that you can get to your policy objectives without taking on a lot of risk and spending a lot of money.
So much of our economy in Canada, especially in Western Canada, is rooted in the fact that we derive great wealth from the extraction of carbon from the earth in a variety of different formats. What are we going to do when we stop doing that? How does the economy adapt? Yes, we go, okay, we're getting a cleaner environment, but what happens to all those people who worked in that sector? Where do they go? And where do governments get the missed revenue that was being generated?
We're talking about something that's many, in my opinion, many decades down the road.
Yeah.
So if we talk about the Paris Climate Accord, my take on that is that we agreed to do, humans as a species agreed to do two things. One is decarbonize the energy systems we have now as mm-hmm. much as we can, and at the same time develop the clean energy technologies that will be coming up to eventually replace those. So we're going to do the best we can with what we have, mm-hmm. and then we're going to continue to pour money and time and policy into these new technologies. So what Rachel Notley has done over in Alberta, and this isn't well understood in BC, and it needs to be better understood, is they put in a suite of very innovative policies, much of it developed in conjunction with industry, to basically take carbon out of the barrel in the oil sands.
And that's at source.
At source. So mm-hmm. this is a big deal because the oil sands are like 26% of the GHG emissions in Canada. So what there's an index that was created by the California Air Resources Board a couple of years ago. And so on that index, a 5 or 10 score would get you like the average carbon intensity, the carbon intensity of the average American crude oil.
Mm-hmm.
The oil sands crude scored in the low 20s to low 30s, some of them maybe high 30s. There were lots of, other crudes that were in the 50s, and some near Nigerian brass was like 82. Mm-hmm. So there's lots more carbon intense crude oil.
Yeah.
So what they're going to do in Alberta is they're going to implement new technologies to bring that carbon intensity down to 5 or 10,
mm-hmm.
which would be the same level. And there's even speculation that they can bring it down to 0. So now what we have is, and this is heavy crude, right? So there's millions of barrels a day of refining capacity around the world, including 2.7 million barrels a day in Texas on the Gulf Coast that needs heavy crude.
Yep.
So if you now have Alberta crude oil, oil sands crude that has a carbon intensity rating of 0, and you can and you're displacing Mexican Mayan or Venezuelan or Nigerian oil, that's at 30 or 40 or 50, oil sands crude is now a net benefit, a net carbon benefit. It's not a carbon bomb. It's not dirty oil. You're actually helping in terms of the strategy, the Paris Climate Accord strategy. And that's a new, that's going to be a hard one for a lot of British Columbians to swallow, but that's the direction the Alberta government is headed in.
Well, they also have the issue of trying to get their oil to Tidewater, and they've got a big fight here in British Columbia.
They do.
And, what's the argument that they have to bring to that battlefield to get social license or public acceptance here in British Columbia.
The exact opposite of the one they've been using. I've been...
Which is, it's the law? Or the National Energy Board has ruled on it?
The rule of law is the absolute worst argument. And I wrote a very critical column of Rachel Notley a couple of weeks ago because she said, when the summer's over, I'm going to go over to BC and I'm going to talk to British Columbians and I'm going to tell them, we already approved it, rule of law. British Columbians are not in the mood to hear about the rule of law. Mm-hmm. You have to use a different argument. So in early May, at the invitation of the Canadian Green Party here in BC, I defended the oil sands and the Trans Mountain expansion pipeline in a public debate with Dr. Gordon Cornwall. And my argument went like this. So I just outlined the general strategy for the Paris Climate Accords and what the Notley government is doing. In addition to taking carbon out of the barrel, they're also will be partially upgrading some of that oil so that it's now, instead of a bitumen, it'll be a medium or heavy crude that doesn't require diluent. So no more dilbit going through the TMX pipeline. So if you take away those two things, now it's low emission, GHG emissions, and there's no dilbit. And that and the efforts that have been made to upgrade the pipeline design and the efforts that have been made around spill response and around tanker safety with the extra tugs and all of that.
Emergency response.
Right. So my argument to the Green Party audience, there was about 100, 150 people there that night. My argument was Canada has come to the table to accommodate your concerns. Alberta has come to the table to accommodate your concerns. It has been made as safe as possible. Carbon's being taken out of the barrel. Diluent's going to be taken out of the crude oil. Everybody's done the best they can. Now you have, as neighbors of Alberta, you have a moral obligation to do your part and not stand in the way of that pipeline.
North American Energy News. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. It was a pleasure.